Good evening. The United Nations confirms a Washington Post columnist was murdered in the Saudi Arabian consulate in Istanbul. World Refugee Day and reparations for the descendants of slaves is debated in Congress. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Wednesday, June 2019. The United Nations released a report on the killing last year of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi on Wednesday. The bottom line finding is that there is credible evidence that Saudi Arabia's crown prince and other high-level officials are personally liable for the grisly murder. Special Rapporteur Agnes Callamard added a new twist to the story. She says while Khashoggi was certainly a wanted man, the original plan may have been to kidnap him to face Mohammed bin Salman personally. The murder may have been Plan B when it seemed the victim would not cooperate. Saudi Arabia has 11 yet unidentified people on trial for the murder and is seeking the death penalty for five of them, but Callamard says the trial is a farce and fails to meet international standards. Callamard spoke with Al Jazeera on Wednesday. She says the unanswered question is who ordered Khashoggi's murder when he arrived at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul.
The state of Saudi Arabia is first and foremost responsible for the murder. I think it's important to insist that the execution of Mr. Khashoggi was a killing by the state. We have focused extensively on the identity of various individuals that were involved in the commission of the crime. But first and foremost, we must insist in putting the responsibility of the killing to the state of Saudi Arabia. It must bear responsibility for that killing, and it must take action as a state to repair the killing. Of course, who ordered is important, but there are a range of other responsibilities that are involved in the commission of the crime. So is somebody responsible for inciting, directly or indirectly? Did somebody fail to prevent? Did somebody fail to stop the execution? The killing of Mr. Khashoggi was preceded over the year by a range of violations. The execution of Mr. Khashoggi falls within that context, within a campaign directed at people perceived to be undermining or threatening the state. So based on the information that was made available to me, including some 70 minutes of recording in the days and on the day of his execution, there is little doubt in my mind that the killing was premeditated. It was planned. It may be possible that the primary objective was the kidnapping of Mr. Khashoggi, which is also, by the way, and I wish to insist upon that, a violation of international human rights law. It is possible that the kidnapping was the first objective and the killing as an option if the kidnapping failed. The recording before the executions, the recording I have been able to listen to with my personal interpreter, those recordings indicate that an hour before the killing, the dismemberment of Mr. Khashoggi's body was already discussed by the doctor and other individuals. Those are indication in my view that at the minimum the killing was indeed planned and prepared for. The recordings need to be interpreted. They do not tell a very straightforward story. What was done to his body, I cannot deduct from the sounds I have heard. I can infer from the sounds that something was done based on the technical knowledge of the various people I have consulted. It is well possible that Mr. Khashoggi was first first injected with something and then that he was asphyxiated with a plastic bag. This is one of the possibility. The nature and the extent of the dismemberment of his body, this I cannot comment upon. It's not possible. My report makes a range of recommendations, including to Saudi Arabia. As a special rapporteur, I am committed to establishing constructive relationship with the governments that I work with. I have attempted to work with Saudi Arabia for the last 6 months. They have not shown any interest in doing so. My report includes a range of recommendations, including with regard to the ongoing trial, including with regard to a step that Saudi Arabia should take to demonstrate non-repetition, which is a fundamental dimension of their responsibilities, given that I have established that the responsibility of the state is involved. In my opinion, the circumstances of the killing of Mr. Khashoggi are so grave in terms of the violations of international law that, in my opinion, it meet the threshold of seriousness required for universal jurisdiction. Mr. Khashoggi was a resident of the United States. He was a known and renowned member of the press corps in the United States. And in many ways, in my opinion, he embodied a fundamental freedom and principle within the American Constitution, which is the First Amendment. For those reasons, I believe the United States has a stake in pursuing all means at its disposal to ensure that accountability is delivered, including a trial. The United States is a country where the judicial system and the judicial institutions remain independent and impartial. If there are proceedings initiated by individuals, by plaintiff, I see no systemic reasons that would prevent those complaints to proceed as per the American system. So the president and others may have their own misgivings regarding a trial and regarding criminal or civil investigation, but I do not think that this will impact on American institutions, including the justice system, or indeed on the American Congress or Senate, to proceed with what they see to be their key function. I believe that accountability for Mr. Khashoggi can take many forms. Judicial accountability is, of course, the highest objective and something that I am hoping will happen. But beside judicial accountability, we also need to look for other forms of accountability. They can be diplomatic. They can be political. They can be symbolic. In my report, I make a range of recommendations, such as the establishment of special funds to support press freedom in the Middle East, the creation of or the establishment of different symbolic events, conferences, anything that would be based on what Mr. Khashoggi stood for at the end of his life, so that we ensure that his commitment to democracy, commitment to human rights, commitment to press freedom do find a realization through the actions of individuals, states, and civil society and the media.
Special Rapporteur Agnes Callamard on the United Nations findings in the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. President Trump has refused to condemn the Saudi government or the Crown Prince, but South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham came out swinging on Wednesday. Graham said that he personally felt betrayed. He also insisted that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who is widely seen as de facto leader of Saudi Arabia, was directly responsible for the murder. He did it. It wouldn't have happened without him, Graham, who is typically a close ally of the president, argued. The senator said that if the kingdom wanted a normal relationship with the United States, it must act normal. What happened in Saudi Arabia is not normal, he asserted. Thursday is World Refugee Day. It's promoted by the United Nations to honor the courage, strength, and determination of women, men, and children who are forced to flee their homeland under threat of persecution, conflict, and violence. The UN Commissioner for Refugees says in 2018 there were a staggering 70 million individuals forcibly displaced worldwide because of persecution, conflict, violence, or human rights violations. A further 5.4 million are Palestinians who are administered under a different UN program. Palestinians have experienced the longest stretch as stateless refugees, nearly 70 years of any group, but the conflicts in Syria and Africa have added millions more. In recent days, President Trump has announced his plans to mass deport millions of undocumented immigrants in the United States. sowing fear in a population that lives under the shadow of arrest and deportation. Thousands more are being kept in detention cages and camps, including children, along the southern border with Mexico. On Thursday, a rally in support of refugees, who activists say are mostly immigrants, will be held in New York City. The director of African Communities Together is Amaha Kasa. He says Trump's talk is meant to terrorize.
This is an international day in recognition of refugees and humanitarian immigration. Over the last several years, it's become the way that we as New Yorkers address the fact that we have a humanitarian crisis, not just at the southern border, but right here in New York City, where hundreds of thousands of refugees, asylum seekers, people with temporary protected status, instead of being welcomed, are either being locked up by this administration or locked out. And to say, you know, that as New Yorkers, that's not what we stand for. We're a city of refuge. We're a city where people from all over the world come from safety and to resist.
Now, the president has said that he sort of let loose this out of the cat out of the bag, so to speak, that they were going to start arresting, ICE was going to start arresting what he said, the president said, millions of people. Do you believe what the president said is accurate? And what are you preparing if in case that does happen?
What we've seen in this administration is that they have sent a very loud and clear message that everybody is a target. Now, are they going to have the resources to pick up everybody who has an order of deportation and put them on a plane? Maybe not right away, but the goal of this kind of announcement and this kind of policy is to spread a climate of fear that makes people afraid, that makes people go underground. We are seeing a lot of people who had been living quietly for years or even decades who are now facing immediate deportation. What we have to do is both prepare to defend community members who might face removal, but also for all our, not just our people under threat of deportation, but all undocumented immigrants, legal immigrants, even citizens who've been made to feel like they are other or unwanted by this administration. Just because we're under attack doesn't mean that we need to hide. We need to stand up.
Now, you see a lot of reference to the fact that President Obama was, quote unquote, the deporter in chief, I think I've heard it said. What do you say to folks who say that Trump is just doing more of what was already being done?
What we've seen that's different in this administration is it's not just an increase in mass removal, mass deportation, which we've certainly seen. It's been a systematic attempt to also cut down every avenue for legal immigration to this country. The Trump administration has gutted the refugee resettlement program. It was around 100,000 refugees resettled in the last year of the Obama administration. This year, we're talking about 20 or 25,000. Those are tens of thousands of people seeking safety in the U.S. who have been turned away. They've attacked programs like the Diversity Visa Program. They have slashed the Temporary Protected Status Program, attempted to end that, and have only been turned back by the courts. So this is what we're seeing is, you know, yes, there's mass deportation as there was under Obama administration, and frankly, under really every administration, Democratic and Republican. But what we're seeing is much more systematic and cruel way of shutting the doors and kicking out and targeting those who are already here.
What's the difference between a refugee, this is World Refugee Day, and another type of immigrant who might come?
Under international law, which the U.S. has signed on to, a refugee is someone who, because of their status, cannot return to their home country, or maybe they don't even have a home country, without persecution. So that's on account of things like their political opinion, but also their ethnic group. We see a lot of LGBT migrants from places, you know, from a lot of countries in Africa that have instituted repressive anti-LGBT laws. We really see refugee as a humanitarian immigrant, somebody who has to immigrate because of humanitarian reasons. So TPS holders, asylum seekers, all of those are, when we talk about refugees, we're talking about all of those folks. And frankly, a lot of people who are considered immigrants are in fact refugees. We think a lot of those arriving at the southern border are refugees fleeing life-threatening risks in their home country. And the response, again, has been to lock them out or lock them up.
Tell us about the event tomorrow. Where and when will it be happening?
We're going to gather at the New York Public Library, 42nd Street and 5th Avenue. We're going to march from there to the U.S. mission to the U.N. We're going to be carrying symbols and photos of particularly children who have died in U.S. custody. We have 6 migrant children in the last year who have died in Border Patrol custody. And we're going to be confronting the U.S. mission to the U.N. and making it clear that our government has blood on its hands. We'll proceed from there to Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza across from the United Nations and across from Trump World Tower to rally and to recommit ourselves to defend the lives of refugees, asylum seekers, and all immigrants and all members of our community. Come on out. You know, there may be, we're expecting a little bit of rain, but when we think about migrants being held under a freeway overpass in El Paso, Texas, in cages in 90-degree temperatures, it's going to be nothing like that, maybe just a little sprinkle, but we're New Yorkers, we're tough, and we stand up for our neighbors.
Amaha Kasa is Director of African Communities Together. You're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. And today is June 19th, the 154th anniversary of Juneteenth, the day that commemorates the announcement of the abolition of slavery in the state of Texas in 1865. And it's also the day when the House Judiciary Committee held a hearing on H.R. 40, calling for reparations for hundreds of years of enslavement for Africans brought here as captives. The first proposal for reparations was made 30 years ago, and it carries the symbolism of 40 acres and a mule, the promise given to freed slaves after the Civil War. Linda Perry reports.
The debate over reparations for descendants of slaves moved from the campaign trail to Congress on Wednesday with a call for lawmakers to address compensation for America's history of racism and Jim Crow laws. The House Judiciary Committee held a hearing on this anniversary of June 19th, Juneteenth, to look at H.R. 40, legislation which would set up a bipartisan commission to study the issue. It puts a spotlight on a national conversation over the legacy of slavery. This isn't a new debate. The debate over reparations for Black Americans began not long after the end of the Civil War, and a resolution to study reparations was first proposed in 1989 by John Conyers of Michigan, who put it forward year after year. Visitors lined up Wednesday to attend the hearing, but a day before the hearing, Kentucky Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he opposes reparations.
I don't think reparations for something that happened 150 years ago for whom none of us currently living are responsible is a good idea. We've tried to deal with our original sin of slavery by fighting a civil war, by passing landmark civil rights legislation. We've elected an African-American president. I think we're always a work in progress in this country, but no one currently alive was responsible for that.
This rebuttal proffers a strange theory of governance, that American accounts are somehow bound by the lifetime of its generations.
Writer Ta-Nehisi Coates drew new attention to the issue with his 2014 essay, The Case for Reparations.
Enslavement reigned for 250 years on these shores. When it ended, this country could have extended its hallowed principles, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to all regardless of color. But America had other principles in mind. And so for a century after the Civil War, Black people were subjected to a relentless campaign of terror, a campaign that extended well into the lifetime of Majority Leader McConnell. It is tempting to divorce this modern campaign of terror, of plunder, from enslavement. But the logic of enslavement, of white supremacy, respects no such borders. And the god of bondage was lustful and begat many heirs, coup d'etats and convict leasing, vagrancy laws and debt peonage, redlining and racist GI bills, poll taxes and state-sponsored terrorism. We grant that Mr. McConnell was not alive for Appomattox, but he was alive for the electrocution of George Stinney. He was alive for the blinding of Isaac Woodward. He was alive to witness kleptocracy in his native Alabama and a regime premised on electoral theft. Majority Leader McConnell cited civil rights legislation yesterday, as well he should, because he was alive to witness the harassment, jailing, and betrayal of those responsible for that legislation by a government sworn to protect them. He was alive for the redlining of Chicago and the looting of Black homeowners of some $4 billion. Victims of that plunder are very much alive today. I am sure they'd love a word with the majority leader. What they know, what this committee must know, is that while emancipation deadbolted the door against the bandits of America, Jim Crow wedged the windows wide open. And that is the thing about Senator McConnell's something. It was 150 years ago, and it was right now. The typical black family in this country has 1/10 the wealth of the typical white family. Black women die in childbirth at 4 times the rate of white women. And there is, of course, the shame of this land of the free, boasting the largest prison population on the planet, of which the descendants of the enslaved make up the largest share. The matter of reparations is one of making amends and direct redress, but it is also a question of citizenship. In H.R. 40, this body has a chance to both make good on its 2009 apology for enslavement and reject fair-weather patriotism, to say that a nation is both its credits and its debits, that if Thomas Jefferson matters, so does Sally Hemings, that if D-Day matters, so does Black Wall Street, that if Valley Forge matters, so does Fort Pillow. Because the question really is not whether we will be tied to the somethings of our past, but whether we are courageous enough to be tied to the whole of them.
It's not often that you hear the words of a young man and they enliven your emotional memory, your historic memory, as he just did at this moment. Thank you so much.
Actor activist Danny Glover says he's deeply honored to be at the House Judiciary hearing on the reckoning of the crime against humanity.
A national reparations policy is a moral, democratic, and economic imperative. I sit here as the great-grandson of a former slave, Mary Brown, who was freed by the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1st, 1863. I had the fortune of meeting her as a small child. I also sit here as the grandson of Reese May Huntley and Rufus Mack Huntley. My maternal grandparents, who were both born before Plessy versus Ferguson, the Supreme Court decision in 1896. And for a significant portion of their lives, they worked as sharecroppers and tenant farmers in rural Georgia until they were able to save enough money to purchase a small farm. They were subsistence farmers. Despite much progress over the centuries, this hearing is yet another important step in the long and heroic struggle of African Americans to secure reparations for the damages inflicted by enslavement and post-emancipation and racial exclusionary policies. Many of the organizations who are present today at this hearing are amongst the historical contributors to the present national discourse, congressional deliberations, and Democratic Party presidential campaign policy discussions about reparations. So I call on all of the elected public officials in Congress to demonstrate your commitment in action today and stand forth with Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee and co-sign H.R. 40.
Representative Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas became the sponsor of H.R. 40, the measure to study reparations after the retirement of Democratic Representative John Conyers. She addressed the packed hearing room.
Judiciary Committee, what better place to have this hearing? And to those who are, again, trying to understand our process, you have to have a hearing. Then there is something called a markup. Then there is a vote in the committee. And then there's the opportunity to go to the floor of the House of Representatives, on to the Senate, which will be the other body, as we call it. And the challenge that I will accept, and I hope that you will accept, and then a signature by a president of the United States of America. Let this day, June 19th, 2019, be the marker for the commitment for each and every one of you who have come to support to say, on my watch, we will watch this bill pass and be signed by the President of the United States of America.
Organizers say H.R. 40 is about respect and reconciliation and the hope that one day all Americans can walk together towards a more just future. H.R. 40 does not mandate financial payments of any kind, and it doesn't prejudge the outcome of the commission's work. Instead, it sets forth a process by which a diverse group of experts and stakeholders can study the complex issues involved and make recommendations. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.
And today is June 19th, the 154th anniversary of Juneteenth, the day that commemorates the announcement of the abolition of slavery in the state of Texas in 1865. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, June 19th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry and Reva Goldberg. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News on Juneteenth, I'm Paul DiRienzo.